linguistic objects. Help.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. I'm Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. We've got a really great program for you today. It's actually part of the first series of Palenque Norte lectures that were given at Burning Man in the year 2003. As any of you who have been to the Playa know, that there's a lot of challenges in producing anything on the Playa. Actually, there's a lot of challenges just in surviving, and particularly if it's your first year there, which actually it was for the Gray family. And the talk that we're presenting today, as you already know, is from Zena, Allison, and Alex Gray, and it came on Saturday, the day of the burn, and it came at the wonderful hour of noon. Now, who the idiot was that scheduled Alex Gray and family to speak at noon in the desert on the Playa at Burning Man on the day of the burn ought to have his head examined. And the truth is, I decided never to do something that stupid again. But anyhow, it was by far the biggest crowd we ever had for one of our lectures. It was a real overflow crowd. We counted, and there were close to 500 people there. And it was just amazing. Not inside the pod, of course. It was packed to the gills. And to the 500 or so that were able to hear it on the live in person there, there were several thousand who caught it on K-Pod radio that we were broadcasting in Black Rock City at the time. So if you go to our website at matrixmasters.com, there's actually a link on the front page with Alex Gray's name on it, and it'll take you right to a page where there's some pictures of this particular event, and you can kind of see what it looked like when the recordings were made. Our particular challenge at Palenque Norte was the quality of the recording that day. Our direct feed from the board failed, and the handheld MP3 mic that was being passed around got switched off, and so most of this talk was captured on my cassette tape recorder that I just put on the DJ stand there, and so it's kind of a recording of what it sounded like inside the pod. And you know, it's not the greatest quality recording at all, but at least it did get saved. And I'd like to have a much clearer recording, this will at least give you a better feeling of what it was like that day on the Playa. All in all, the Gray's talk lasted about an hour and a half, so we can't put it all into one podcast here. The file would just get too immense, and so we're breaking it into two parts, part one and part two. This is obviously part one, and part two we're going to have up on the web at the same time we post this, so you won't have to wait for the Psychedelic Salon number 8. Before we introduce the talk, by the way, I want to thank my friends Jacques Cordell and Wells of Chatel Hayuk for letting us use a cut from their CD, which is entitled Nature Loves Courage. Boy, that's a great title, by the way, guys. I love it. Nature Loves Courage. As I mentioned in the beginning, our recording quality could be better, but the quality of the Gray's presentation is just excellent. In fact, I really don't know if there's a better explanation of how to create a family life that's in harmony with what Terence McKenna espoused in his philosophy of a psychedelic society. And for those of you, by the way, who might still be living at home and have the feeling that your parents just don't get it, you might want to give some thought to asking your parents to listen with you to the two-part talks of the Gray family, and I seriously doubt if you'll find a more rational discussion about the use of our sacred medicines in the context of a well-grounded and very highly creative family life. So anyhow, that's something I think you ought to think about. It'd be probably a good move. You might be surprised at how open and rational some parents can be. Well, some parents, at least in the blue states, huh? So, let's take a listen now to Zena, Allison, and Alex Gray talk about art, love, family, and psychedelics.
was it to say hello and be the first to say hello. And I want to acknowledge you for coming in this hot 12 o'clock. I didn't think that anybody would be up by now. So we were amazed at the crowd. We were very, very touched. And thank you so much for being here for our talk. I'm Allison Gray, and if you know Alex. And I just wanted to introduce Dina Gray, who usually doesn't sit up with us, but we invited her to do that because of our topic, which is art, love, family, and psychedelics. And because of that topic, Dina is very much a part of our art, love, family, and psychedelics sort of talk or our thoughts on those subjects. And so I invited her if she has any comments to just chime in. And, of course, we're going to try to keep it somewhat brief, keep our comments on those four subjects, that's art, love, family, and psychedelics, somewhat brief, and then let you ask questions. And, of course, you can also address your questions to Dina. So, without further ado, I'll let Alex begin a brief comment on art.
Thank you, and thank you, Lorenzo, for that introduction. And just being here at Burning Man is it's just such an incredible concrescence of creative energy that is completely sort of unauthorized by the art sort of establishment. And this is, to me, the most inspiring gathering on the planet, because it gives us hope that we're not living only under the boot, but that our creative vision is really what's supreme. When we're so excited to be able to come to such an inhospitable environment and make it a heaven, it's truly a transformative gift that we give ourselves to be here and be participants. When we're here, we're all artists, and we can recognize and appreciate the greatness of the efforts that have gone into all these striking and inspiring structures. And so we're just so thrilled to be here sharing this time with you. Psychedelics have been, I'd say, one of the most important catalysts for understanding our multi-dimensional reality that Allison and I have had the good fortune to encounter. It happened to be that we met each other while tripping, and that kind of solidified our relationship. We stayed together. It's been our kind of cosmic glue for the last 27 years. And so that coincidence of what I like to think of as angels' tears, tears cried in compassion through the molecular hijinks in Dr. Hoffman's lab many years ago, was that kind of micrograms of opening that allowed us to recognize each other as this force of God that we wanted to bring into our lives together and share that. So since psychedelics has given us this experience of pure, infinite awareness, infinite love that forms the basis of our relationship, it also informs all these other subjects of art and love, our family, and all the things we wanted to talk about today. So, in the subject of art, regarding the subject of art, and it's such an appropriate subject given the expressions that are all going on here, from what we wear to what we listen to what we are observing, what we're driving in, what we're writing on. All of these have been subject to the scrutiny of our creative awareness. And so one of the things, though, as artists that Allison and I talk about and wonder about is what is the most important thing to make art about? Because even for abstract painters like Barnett Newman, this was his question. And for him, it was the overriding question of what an artist has to answer for themselves is, what is my subject? And so I think that many of us have encountered what that subject is through our various visions and things. It certainly was that way with Allison and I. The psychedelics opened us up to a realm of vision and specific visionary experiences that then we've attempted to translate into our art. I think that the Burning Man experience here is, I can't speak for many of the artists because I don't know them, but it certainly, to me, is a externalized hallucination that is like looking at a 3D Dr. Seuss kind of world. You know, we're all in Whoville here.
We hear you.
We're all participants in this kind of extraordinary externalization of the soul, which was really what Terrence was harping on for us, you know, when he was saying the pedal to the metal in the art direction was to find this way to externalize the DMT realms, all the realms that are inherent to our creative imagination and have been visited by all the various cultures throughout the millennia. We can look at the Islamic architecture and the temple structures from all over the world. And these are also keynotes and reference points that are incorporated into the beautiful and outrageously grand structures that David Best and the Burning Man Pyramid and all these magnificent structures that are so inspiring, they're taken, it seems, directly from these inner worlds. So, however, do you want to start to say some things here, Allison? Yeah.
Well, I'm just going to say briefly that, you know, in considering being an artist, I think that there are three things, or at least the three that come to my mind right now, to be considered. Three questions, really. One is what to make art about, which is what Alex is just talking about. And, you know, we determined some time ago, while journeying on LSD, that the thing to make art about would be the most important thing. I mean, and I, you know, no one can tell you what that is, but for us, it was our experience of the infinite oneness and unity of all beings and things. We could go on and on poetically describing that, but that's what poets are for, is to describe that. And so what to make art about, that's an important consideration for every artist, and we recommend making it about the most important thing. That's why we're visionaries, you know, that's why visionary artists make art, because they want to make the art about the visions that are the most important to them. So you have to look inside and see what's the most important thing and express it and try to express it the best way you can so that you're communicating that most important thing to the most people. You know, a lot of times we teach and we see people who will come to us with their art and they'll tell us, you know, what it's supposed to say or what the vision was. But you don't get that from the vision. That's the problem. So being an artist is a problem, and it's what you have to overcome is how to communicate that most important thing in the most communicative way. So that's the first question. The second question is how do I do it physically? You know, time and money. It's like, how do I get the time and the money to do the things to fulfill my vision? So So that's your second problem. These are all problems. I'm not going to tell you how to answer them. I'm just going to tell you what they are. You know, time and money. And I, you know, we're always advising people to, you know, carve out a few hours, if not more. Some of us make art all the time, or we focus our life on our art. But even if you don't, even if you work in a cubicle, but even if you do, you know, to come home and to carve out a few hours a day for your creative outlet could mean so much to your life, could be so enriching to us. What would it be if you did that? I mean, some of us already do that, but if you don't do that, what happens to you? You know, how are you dried out inside when you don't find the time and the money? And the money, of course, you know, we can spend great deals of money, we can spend very little money. Art materials can be very inexpensive, can be found objects. You know, we've all seen Andy Goldsworthy's work. You know, it goes out in the woods, sticks and leaves. Or, you know, there's people who build huge structures. So we have to, you know, adapt to that. But these are the concerns. The second concern being time and money. The third concern that we came up with, is what can art do? You know, why be an artist? Why even, you know, and I think... I think what I was just saying for one thing, the fulfillment that you'll get from being an artist.
What art can do? Well, I think that for one thing, it does represent that force of cosmic creativity. That if we're in a universe, we're in a cosmos that is constantly undergoing creation, destruction, recreation, and on such a scale, such an infinite scale in all the galaxies and all the various planets and who knows what kind of life forms have emerged in these various physical worlds, as well as all the multidimensional inner worlds and subtle worlds that we've visited, there's an ongoing boundless field of awareness that's generating news, you know. And when we tap in, we get to a glimpse of these other realms and other dimensions, and that they're informing us, they're educating us. You know, the universe is like a university that we come to learn something about. How do we express what we learn? How do we digest it? How do we integrate whatever knowledge we have in our lives? And to me, the nature of the creative act, and whether it's, you know, building a website or writing a song or doing a dance, painting a picture, making a drawing, all of these things, making movies, films. All of these things are expressions of getting you in alignment with this creative force, or this force of universal creativity that we're all an expression of. We couldn't be here unless the universe evolved exactly as it did. And so here we are, these jabbering collections of molecules here. And here, just for a brief time, this little package is just like whizzing through space and time, and, you know, we're soon to die and all that. But what does it all mean to you? And art, for, you know, through the millennia, what survives, you know? We go back and we look at the artworks of all the various cultures. And this is how we get a vibe of, my God, they were going through and dealing with the same kind of shit that we're dealing with now. You know, this is a way of extending the human family and human consciousness, and passing on the gift of appreciation of where you are, where you've been, where you are. Artwork can function like that. Certainly for the artist, there's that function of just that kind of healing, getting the monster or getting the inspiration outside of yourself. So art's a creative healing force for those who are engaged in it, but also those who are sensitively open to letting it in. If you're receptive to great works of art, there is a kind of ego-transcending moment where your mind merges with the
inspiration is totally out of their mind as well. So what you have is a connection point, a kind of a mode, a portal into that alternative moment or glimpse of liberation or whatever space. Maybe it's a glimpse of hell. Maybe, you know, whatever the glimpse is that brought the artist out of themselves and into the presence, then you too, through your sensitive viewing, can merge with that moment and likewise live that inspiration. So the sharing of inspiration is the, I think, the greatest thing that art can do. It empowers any creative act that we want to take in our lives. To have come here and to have witnessed all the various arts and continually evolving, and it is a way of you bringing back that energy into your life and whatever the hell you're doing, you know, then, gee whiz, can I imagine making this drawing? Well, look at Black Rock City, my God, you know, of course, give yourself the space to do it, just try it, you know, and so... Most creative ideas seem outlandish and ridiculous to begin with. And so this should inspire one, I think, to take those steps. And God knows we need the enthusiasm and the hope that any of our creative efforts can add up to sustaining our planetary web of life, or all the various kind of ideals, creating a life of love and a community that is recognizing each other as expressions of the divine. These are sort of moments of interreflectivity that I like to think about as, you know, we're all sacred mirrors of each other. That's the whole point of the thinking about sacred mirrors. And the artworks that we do can express that. So that's, I've jabbered long enough here.
So the next topic we were going to touch on is love. And we think we know a lot about love. We all probably know a lot about love. But, you know, we're really, when we talk about love, we were going to sort of touch on the part about relationships, like, you know, finding a relationship. Because people often ask us about our relationship. You know, we've been together for such a long time, and we still find it interesting being together, and, you know, and really love each other. We've been devoted and committed, you know, for quite a while. And, of course, you know, we said that was your best thing. That's what she told us, that the thing she did the best was love, which she felt like she was very little. And I think that's true, too. But we're really talking here about relationships. And in considering finding that person for yourself, you first have to find the right person. I mean, you know, that's the hardest or easiest part, I'm not sure. But how do you find that right person? And how do you know that that person is the right person? That's a book-long topic, and I won't go into it entirely, but we'll touch on a couple of points. And we often start by quoting our friends Robbie and Judy Gass, who teach courses on such things, and they also are a couple that've been together for a long time. And they said, "Choose good and stop choosing." This is a good thing to remember. You know, choose good is sort of like the problem. You got to choose good to begin with. And if you don't know what love looks like, there's a long list, you know, of things that love doesn't look like. And you have to recognize those things. And you have to know what love does look like, what love looks like, you know, nurturing, supporting, through all the various things that each person in the couple wants to do, not limiting, and just, you know, you have to determine what love looks like. That's a long topic. But once you have chosen that right person, stop choosing. A lot of people choose that person, and then they keep looking, you know, and that doesn't work.
When you do that, now he has a black box.
You know, that's really up to every individual. Maybe some people here are still looking. I don't know. But for us, that worked. And for everybody, it works differently. So I'm not trying to say that ours is the only kind of relationship that a person can have. We know that people have open relationships and whatever works for you. But for us, what worked is to choose and stop choosing and choose good, because I think we both felt like we had made a good choice. And one of the ways that we made a good choice, there's a lot of aspects of making a good choice. Chemistry is very important. You know that you can be, best friends is number one. We always put best friends at the top. It's good to be, in a relationship with your best friend. Because then, there's that, you always want the best for your best friend, and they always want the best for you. So the best friend thing is good, but then there has to be chemistry, because I know we've all had relationships with a person who's our best friend, but we don't have the chemistry, maybe, the sexual attraction. That's pretty important. I mean, you gotta have that. It's gotta stay there. In the relationship. I don't know. I mean, that's what's very important. But in choosing, if you're in a position where you don't have that one person, you haven't found that one person, and you are searching, and you feel like you wonder, how am I going to ever find that person? Here's a piece of advice that we say. It's basically pursue what you love. Start getting busy pursuing. Having a passion is really an important thing. And if you pursue what you love, you will attract people. Nobody wants to be with somebody who's sort of uninteresting or doesn't have a passion. You need to find your passion. And once you've found your passion, you will just instantly attract people. People are attracted to passionate people. So whatever it is that you love, just pursue it. And then, if you don't find that person that you love, at least you're doing what you love. You just spend your life doing what you love. So what could be better, I know it may seem impossible, to find that absolutely perfect person. But, you don't want to stop pursuing your passion. So I think that's very important part of finding.
Well, just going back to the tripping reference points, on probably every trip that we take together, but one of the ones that Allison and I were on, we recognized. I was working in an anatomy lab where we had a lot of samples of human pathology and things like that. And many of those were Siamese twins. And they were quite extraordinary. And one of them was these babies that were connected at the head. And it's called craniophagus. Wherever there's a connection with Siamese twins, they call it ophagus, thoracophagus, with your thorax is attached to the other. And so we recognized that we were spiritophagous, and that, in fact, we're all spiritophagous, we're one mass of interconnectedness, but to be able to recognize that as the basis of your relationship, that there is a commonality of spiritual love energy that you share, that's flowing through both of you. And you're both an expression of that, a kind of a unique meat package of that infinite creative love energy. And so we're all here in this love circuit. So I think of being able to recognize each other as an expression of that universal love was one key recognition. Why look elsewhere? You could equally argue, well, then why not look everywhere, But for us, and just because we're artists, we like to get things done, too, and we care so much for each other, that there was the notion that, well, look, you are an expression of the all and the divine, and gee whiz, we had this recognition with each other. Let's honor that as the core of our relationship. And one of the other trips, when I was staring at Allison in this kind of meditative, back and forth, tantric kind of, hello, how are you, just eye bridge thing, it was like, and probably this is happening to everybody, but in a similar situation, where you recognize, like, human, every person kind of mask, that, yes, we're this flesh, this particular conglomeration, but equally, we're, I don't know what that was or what it was trying to show me, but we're everyone at the same time. And not only just like humans of every sort of race and physiognomy, but there were also expressions of the animal life forms and things like that as well that were running through it. Just like, here we are. We're life forms. We contain all being within ourselves. And just to recognize that, well, if you're everyone, why should I look elsewhere? You know, may as well stay right here. You know.
So now you found the person. If you found that person, how do you keep it interesting? How do you maintain that relationship? How do you, you know, keep it going for the rest of your life? Because even though I haven't had the rest of my life, I tell you, the 27 years is really, it's a great training. It's great, you know, for honing yourself. I mean, this is one thing I was going to say, that that in order to have a really working relationship, you have to believe that there is some honing to do here, you know. That basically, you're not, you know, you're not enlightened yet, and there are areas that are rough, edges that could be smoothed and, you know, and honed, and you have improvements to make. So you, if you see this person as assisting you in that process, that's a good way of, you know, because it, you know, if you think you have problems, then they're all their fault. That's, you're wrong. You know, it's basically, you got stuff too. So in order to, you know, kind of go through your stuff and learn more about yourself and become a better person, that's a good reason to have a long-term relationship, and it does help you to discover those things about yourself and to, you know, have transformation in your life. Because, you know, what else is important but transformation? I mean, we can have that for our whole life. And one of the principles that we think is interesting about transformation, or for us, is we call it the theory of compatible pathologies, which means that, you know, each one of us is a sickie. You know, Alex, you know, has, when we were first together, he had issues with depression, and he gets kind of depressed, and that's the way he manifests his, you know, his negativity, sort of like, you know, self, you know, I don't know, loathing, whatever. And then I'm sort of like more like the cheerleader, and I'm like, oh, everything's great, and, you know, it's going to be fine, and I've got this sort of like positive. But on the other hand, I grew up in a very angry genes, you know, where I have like this tendency to like, you know, occasionally get moody or angry. Well, Alex grew up in this sort of Protestant home where they never got angry. So that helped a lot, you know, to have somebody in my life that never got angry, and it was really great, you know, influence on me. So we both kind of tempered a lot in those ways, and we know that about each other, that, you know, my pathologies are tempered by Alex's strengths and vice versa, and that's compatible pathology. So if you can see that in another person, that you're not totally, you know, like, well and whole, and could become, you know, healed through that person. We've had many healings through each other. And the other principle that we call the better than me principle, it's very helpful to see that person as, you know, sort of awesome, like, whoa, you know, Alex will be, you know, we'll be sitting in our pod, you know, we have this pod of draft tables, the three of us, and we'll be sitting there working, and I'll say, you know, what are you thinking about? And, you know, Alex will say, oh, I was just, you know, I'll be sitting at my table, and I'll be thinking about, like, what we're going to have for dinner, and, like, what my mother just said to me, and how I'm going to, you know, what I'm going to wear to the party next week. And Alex will be, you know, like, I just was reading Hegel, and it was so fascinating how it relates to what I read last week about Schopenhauer, and, like, he's, like, doing this whole philosophical thing in his head. It just brings me out of my, you know, myself. And I think, whoa, you know, why is he, you know, interested in me? I can't believe that he would, like, have chosen me. And he's just brilliant and all that kind of stuff. So feeling that way, and hopefully, you know, and not just hopefully, but, you know, Alex tells me that he feels similarly about me in my selection of him. Having those feelings about each other really helps to keep the relationship together, because you keep seeing that person. It's about admiration and respect. We talked about chemistry and best friend, and then there's admiration and respect. I think those are important points.
I just wanted to add with that I completely concur, and this is just to underscore what Allison said. Nanpai Norbu, who is a Tibetan Buddhist master and one of our teachers, said that the principle of sort of the transmission that you're trying to get from your guru, like if you take on a guru, then it really matters how you regard them. And of course, in this lifetime, Allison and Zena are my gurus, and so and Norbu as well, most of you. Importantly, Allison's my main guru, and so he was saying it really matters how you regard your guru. If you regard them as a dog, then you'll get the transmission and of a dog. You know, if you regard them as a normal person, then you'll get this kind of transmission of just a normal person. If you regard them as an enlightened Buddha, as a force of spiritual awakening in your life, in a sense transcending some of those other elements, which they may also be, but if you hold them in their essence as that enlightening presence, then that is the transmission, and that is the forward movement that you can expect in your life. And so, for me, she's an expression of that principle, that highest principle. And so, in that, I can trust when I get whacked, you know, like the Zen master's staff, that it's, or as you're walking through the valley of the shadow of the death, you know, and thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. You know, you're talking about a force of the absolute. And if you're able to see past your defenses and see and recognize how they're training you, then that's also a help.
I don't know. I guess we have an abnormally good relationship. A lot of my friends, like, fight with their parents or whatever. I don't know. But, yeah, we disagree, but it's not, like, just because I'm a teenager, we, like, hate each other or something. So, I don't know. We get along pretty well, I think, and this being here is, like, a test for that. And I don't know, just because, like, you have to stay in a room. Well, we're staying in a trailer. We have to stay in a trailer together for a week or whatever. So it's like, I don't know.
How's that going?
Going good. Yeah. Cool.
Right on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we wanted to make one more point about about the love issue, and then we're going to move on to family, where Zena's going to participate even more. I'm hoping we'll talk more about like what it's like to be parents and what it's like to be kids. And, but anyway, so we've talked about finding the person. We've talked about some of the issues of staying with that person. Then there's, you know, how to get through the rough patches, because, you know, you're both not enlightened beings, and you have your stuff that you bring into the relationship. So how do you get through those rough patches? And, of course, Marissa, there we go. What do you do? I mean, you know, everybody says it, everybody knows it, it's obvious communication. You just say that, but, like, what does that mean? You know, communication, if you, you know, it's the way you communicate with that person. It's not just, you know, keeping your mouth moving, you know, chin wagging and small mouth movements, as Sarah would say. It's how you communicate with that person. You know, how you, do you do with consciousness and with love and with an open heart, you know, keeping in mind that you're not playing withhold games like I'm not going to talk to you and, you know, and hurting games like name calling and those kinds of things. So communication is the way to get through rough patches, and learning how to communicate in an open-hearted way is obviously the way to do it. I won't dwell on that because that's pretty obvious to everybody. Just remember communication, communication, communication. And, of course, can I mention this? Because this is what happened to me. I was my first DMT experience, you know, I had all these questions. I had a lot of issues, you know. I had, like, an agenda. I was going to ask the elf and spirit, like, a certain questions I wanted to have answered. And it goes pretty quick, you know. It's like 10 minutes across your vision. So I could see them coming. I mean, I couldn't see any person, actually, but I started with my questions. I was like, you know, how do I be a better parent? I think, you know, I just wanted to be a better parent. And the first thing that happened was they were laughing at me. Like, there they were over there, and they were, like, laughing at me. And I wasn't, like, used to that. I'm taking myself a little too seriously, probably. And I just, like, they were laughing at me. And I was like, okay, well, I've got to ask my questions now. You know, how do I be a better parent? And they said, laugh more. And then I said, well, okay, but how do I be a better wife? You know, how do I be the best partner I could be? Well, laugh more. How do I be the best artist? Well, give me my next art idea. You know, like, I got this art thing and I can't decide. And, like, what am I going to do? Laugh more. So basically, laugh more was all they told me, and they just laughed at me the whole time. And I feel like that's really the best thing to do in a relationship when, you know, things aren't, you know, just remember to laugh more. It's really the way to keep a relationship together. It's a great kind of glue. All right, so our third topic was family. And, you know, some of you you're all part of a family, and some of you have your own families, kids, and whatever. And so the first question is, especially if you're not parents, is why be parents? You know, like, why even be a parent? It's such a lot of work, and it's so hard. And like, why even do it? Some people do decide not to be parents, and I think that's a really good decision for some people. So I'm not thinking that everyone should be parents. Because, you know, if you feel, I thought for a long time that I wouldn't be a parent. Ever since my mother remembers me saying when I was little that I wasn't going to be a parent. And I didn't want to be a parent in my 20s. And then somewhere in my late 30s, I really, it was like, there's nothing I could think about except being a parent. I just wanted to have a child so bad I could feel it. I could taste it. It was like every pregnant person I was jealous of, you know. And I wanted a baby really, really bad when I was about 34. And then we had seen it when I was 36. So if you feel like you need to wait, I just, you know, it's been great being an older mother. I mean, it's actually great because I would have been a terrible mother in my 20s. And I think Zena will tell you whether I've done a good job or not. But I think we get along okay. So I'm going to make my mistakes for sure. But, you know, I think I've done a much better job than I would have. And I'm really glad to have had what we call the parent training. And that's what we came to, was that we didn't want to have the life training without the parent training. You have this one life. This is it, folks, and we only have a certain amount of years to live. And during that training, I wanted to get the parent training, and the parent training is, you know, is really confronting, and it's the hardest, best thing we have ever done, bar none. It's just the hardest thing, and it's the best thing. It's hard, you know, in so many ways. It hones you and smooths your edges, and it confronts you with yourself. There is no one who will be more honest with you than your child. Even your partner won't be as honest with you as your child. Your child will tell you exactly what's up with you. What shit do you have? They will let you know, and you'll be confronted with your shit, you know, on a daily basis. So if you want self-improvement, you know, and transformation in your life, the parent training is a really good training to go with. And that's what we decided. We didn't want to go through the life training without the parent training. So we went ahead and did that. Now, you know, there are entire libraries of books on parenting, and so I won't, you know, try to list them here, but, you know, I'm really, really happy to field questions about parenting and family and this sort of thing.
I think that this relates to what we were talking about before, about recognizing what the guru is an expression of, and thereby what each of us are an expression of. And so if you're thinking about having a child or something like that, then having relationships and things like that, if you can recognize them as this already enlightened presence that is coming into form that you're able to have a relationship with, if that's the basis of your relationship, that you know their inherent goodness and purity and completion already, and you nurture that, you know, it's like what happens when these tulkus get born and they're raised over in Tibet and by those who are honoring them as reincarnated lama, reincarnations of a great enlightening presence. If we could take that as a reference point, it's just in some way, you know, when we're relating to our children, then perhaps that can foster that kind of space and spaciousness and love and presence, compassion, wisdom, all the forces of goodness that we want to help nurture in each other. So that's the getting down to an essence of how I think that we could approach our relationship with each other is just that respect and honor of that level.
Well, I was going to say something about the basic principles of parenting. We were coming up with a list of, frankly, I'm writing a book on the subject, on this whole topic, and so I was sort of enlisting Alex and Dina, and the three of us were coming up with, the subject was, how would we like to be parented? I mean, this is the way I think this is best parenting. It's basically, if you were a child, how would you like to be parented? You know, and coming up with that list, you know, we came up with things like we would like our parents to teach us things. We like our parents to be available to us. We like our parents, and you can come up with this list yourself. I won't go into too much detail with that. But in thinking about, you know, the best way to parent, I think that first number one is seeing your child as a reincarnated Buddha, your guru, your teacher. That, you know, in every stage of the way, you're reflected on yourself. And if you knew that your child was a reincarnated Buddha, would you punish them? Would you hit them? Would you call them names? Would you be sarcastic with them? You know, would you yell at them? So seeing them as a reincarnated Buddha is the first step in being, you know, I think in being aware of yourself as a parent. You know, the Dalai Lama was taken from his parents, but he was raised as a reincarnated Buddha, and you know, you can imagine what his upbringing is like. It had an incredible amount of respect and love, and that's what we, you know, what we all want to do with our children. So that's important. But then just the list of, if you were a child, and we all were children, how would we like to be parented? We would like a parent to forgive us when we make mistakes. We would like a parent to be appropriate in appropriate situations, to be healthy and to take care of themselves, you know, exercise and eat right. We'd like, you know, those kinds of things. I won't go into the whole list, but it was a fun exercise to come up with, like, you know, to be thinking about the way you would like to be parented if you were a child. I think that's a great way to think about parenting.
Sorry, I'm going to have to break into the flow of this wonderful discussion right here, but there's still more than a half hour left, and we don't want to make this podcast just be monstrously long. So we'll sign off for now, and probably see you in Psychedelic Salon number 8, where we're going to bring you part 2 of this great presentation, and it's where Allison and Alex talk about parenting in the psychedelic age, or as Allison likes to call it, parenting in other mind states. And they also tell a little bit about their vision for the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. Of course, this was in 2003, their vision, and a lot has happened since then. You gotta check that out on Alex's website. For you Tool and String Cheese fans, by the way, that part 2 of this talk, Alex does bring up Tool and String Cheese, mentions something about working with them, and they Grays also discuss the relative merits of art school and other educational institutions in general. So unless I miss my guess, we'll probably be seeing you here again in the Psychedelic Salon. For more information about us, you can just go to matrixmasters.com, or to pick up just the audio feeds from our website, you can go to PlanqueNorte.org, PlanqueNorte.org. And we don't have all of our MP3 files in podcast format yet, but you can certainly download them and listen to a lot of the presentations we've produced so far and some that are coming from other producers. And if you haven't been to the Grays websites, you can find them at www.zenagrey.com, Allison Gray, AllisonGrey.com, or Alex Gray, AlexGrey.com. Of course, you can always Google them and find a couple hundred thousand other hits if you're interested and really ambitious. Well, thanks again for joining us here in the Psychedelic Salon. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.